Understanding Psychological Warfare. We're all targets of PSYOPs. Psychological warfare involves tactics intended to manipulate one's opponent or your enemies. The PSYOP emblem in this United States unit is persuade, change, and influence. This includes the dissemination of propaganda and disinformation to undermine the morale of enemy forces and erode their ability or will to resist. In the military, terms like PSYWAR, psychological warfare, or PSYOPs, psychological operations, have also been known as winning hearts and minds, political warfare and propaganda. In the South African Army, it was called COMOPs, or communications operations. Normally, military intelligence would distinguish between PSYOPs' own forces to build up the morale of your own people, PSYOPs' enemy forces to break down the morale of both enemy soldiers and their civilian population, and PSYOPs' local population to win over the hearts and minds of those in the operation area, the huge bulk of people between your forces and the enemy forces, and you've got to win over these people who probably don't like either side, and to at least get them to be neutral, hopefully not to be hostile, not to help the enemy. And so you can see this is sort of Americans in Iraq trying to persuade the local people that they're bombing them for their own good. PSYOPs recognize that they need to target their audience's belief system, their value system, their emotions, their motives, their reasoning, and their behavior. Of course, the goal is change behavior, but you get there by influencing emotions. And this is where cute, sugary, syrupy type commercials, ads, pictures, posters, the different things that they do, they try to aim at the emotions. It's seldom they want to aim at your head because that'll take a long way around how many people are going to agree with people who want to come and bomb you that you want to be on their side. So they've got to try and play with your head and affect your emotions. And make no mistake, Antifa and BLM and 19 other Marxist front organizations in the streets of America are part of a massive PSYOPs operation. Now just take this classic picture. This is of a young boy sleeping with his parents in Syria. Okay? This is a very heartrending picture. Except it's a complete fraud. There's nobody in there. Those aren't graves. This is just, it's a photo op. It's a fraudulent picture which is put in the newspaper in order to give the impression that you should support the war against the Syrian government, where they actually, they were protecting the Christians, the Syrian government, but they wanted people to support the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, ISIS, and all these others, and attack the people of Syria, where most of the people in the Syrian army actually, or most of the Christians are in the army, a very high percentage of the Syrian army are Christians, because they know if the Muslim extremists get control, they can lose their heads and more. Some countries resort to false flag or black ops to discredit the enemy forces by terrorist operations, which can then be attributed to the enemy. And there's a whole lot of PSYOPs. And in fact, we dealt with a whole presentation here just on false flags. Now, you can distinguish between white ops and black ops. So white ops is when it's obviously from you. You've published it in the name of your army, your country, your side. And so there's a certain amount of propaganda that's white. But black ops is when you put in disinformation. You might claim it comes from a neutral source or even from the enemy side to discredit them. But false flags are classic, terrible black ops where they actually kill, blow up, and so on people, and then they blame it on the enemy. And those of you who've seen, for example, the film A Noble Lie, seen a complete evidence that the Clinton administration was completely behind that worst terrorist operation in American history to that date, blowing up the Oklahoma City. Headquarters for the FBI, ATF, and so on, although there wasn't one single government employee in the building at the time the bomb went off during work time, they just all happened to be out at that time. They said they'd all been paged and told not to report to work that day. So how about that? Very thoughtful of terrorists not to to make sure that the people they're targeting aren't there on the day. As to the, every time there's a chemical warfare attack in Syria, it's always been proved to be organized by the, well, the allies, basically. America, NATO, the Saudi Arabians, folks and the Turks, they're all involved in it, to discredit the Syrian government. And it's always timed perfectly. It's been well exposed. The anthrax scare in Washington, D.C. was totally organized by the American government as well to get the people in the state of hysteria. These aren't theories. These are proven admitted at this point. False flags. Psychological warfare is no longer limited to soldiers. Targets of psyops include civilians, groups, churches, organizations, governments are all targeted by psychological warfare. And the new media technology makes this easier than ever before to target civilian populations. Now, just take a blatant case of psyops. Here's Richard Dawkins, the God delusion atheist from Oxford, and he helped sponsor this. There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Well, two can play at that game. The fool has said in his heart, there's no God. Psalm 14 verse 1. So, you know, this is psyops on a religious and atheist level in the streets. And then there's definitely a God, so join the Christian party and enjoy your life. So, you know, bear in mind, if the enemy is within range, so are you. And this is part of it, that psyops isn't just something the enemy does to us. We can do psyops to them. Now, today I'm going to be looking mostly at psyops generally, a little bit on how we can react, but next week I'm planning to look at positive psyops that we've done to undermine the enemy's morale. And your potential medium for psyops is colossal. Everything. Twitter, through Facebook, YouTube, everything out there, every form of media platform can be used for psychological warfare. Technology and media are increasingly being used to affect political changes designed by the enemy or by revolutionary forces. Now, this can be used for good or ill. Take, for example, Brexit. BBC was totally against Brexit. Every political party in government was against Brexit. The British government was against Brexit. The opposition party was against Brexit. The whole mass media told the British people, you've got to stay in the EU. How was it that a miniature party, the Brexit Party and UKIP, managed to get people, well, first it was just United Kingdom Independence Party, which is miniature, and later the Brexit Party, to get them to actually follow up on what they'd voted? How did they do it? By social media. They bypassed the mainstream media and reached a majority of the people in England who agreed we should, and they went against their own mass media and their own government, and even against the opposition parties. In determining Brexit. So Brexit was a victory for social media. The Trump revolution, 2016, that was also a triumph of social media. He bypassed the mass media, who was 100% against them, and he managed to appeal directly to voters through social media. Now, this is a revolution in technology, because this was never possible before. In fact, you didn't used to hear a whole lot of other opinions, because Harry Oppenheimer owned all English newspapers in the country, except for Die Burger. Sorry, except for The Citizen, which was owned by Nationale Presse. And so basically, you had two conglomerates who owned everything. And you didn't hear any news that they didn't want you to have. And by the way, the Oppenheimer Group, De Beers and Anglo-American, also owned all the textbook production in this country. So you didn't really get a chance to hear another side. But now, desktop publishing, a housewife can have a blog, can have a website, can desktop publish a book, can put out a newsletter, and reach people. Whereas before, you had to be a multimillionaire to be able to own a newspaper or something. So right now, that's why the censoring on the internet by YouTube and Facebook and all of this sort of thing, well, they are, and Trump's challenging it because he recognizes they are trying to gear it up so that he doesn't have a way of communicating to his people for the coming elections in 2020. Through fake news and peer pressure, people are taught to self-censor to avoid expressing views that could get them unfriended. Now, during this lockdown, thousands of posts have been taken down. Thousands of sites have been closed down by Facebook and YouTube. They just endlessly are censoring, and you will find some things you posted. I found things I posted which I thought were as authoritative, factual, well-presented, good sources, which suddenly came up. The whole screen turned to fake news. And, for example, the one on tracking down the Wuhan virus, which basically tracked it down to, well, the greatest biological warfare factory in the world, which is in Wuhan. Surprise, surprise. And next thing, instead of, they can't stop pornography on the internet somehow, but they can stop a view that the Big Pharma don't like you bring out something against vaccines, suddenly they'll clamp it down, they'll warn you. I was warned after one posting of something, you know, we will close you down if you share this. And there's a whole lot of my friends who disappear for a month and they say I'm back from Facebook jail. They were blocked for, and then there's people who've got different identities and this gets blocked, and then they have to try and send friend requests and say, by the way, this is me, but I'm just using another identity because I've gotten blocked for saying something unacceptable. So censorship is seriously alive and well. They tell you no name calling, no cyberbullying, no mean words, this, that, and the other, and so on. However, you can say white silence is violence. That's okay. That, you know, if you won't post Black Lives Matter, you're obviously a racist, and you're obviously evil, and you deserve, well, the worst that can be given to you. So, interesting that no cyberbullying, but they will cyberbully you if you don't follow whatever is the flavor of the month at that moment. The Vietnamese commander, Giap, famously declared that the communists did not win the war in Vietnam on the battlefield. They won it on the university campuses and in the living rooms of the United States of America through television coverage of American protests against the war. And he actually said, we must thank the American journalists. If it wasn't for CBS and NBC and ABC and the New York Times and the Washington Post, we'd never have won the war. The U.S. media won the war for the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese were beaten militarily in the field. They knew that. And their commander acknowledged it, but he said, but thank you to the U.S. media and the students who managed to enable us to put so much pressure on the U.S. government that they pulled their troops out from a war they were winning on the ground. Just shows how wars can be won by media. The Prime Minister of Rhodesia, Ian Smith, declared, we were never beaten by our enemies. We were betrayed by our friends. And he wrote a book documenting this, The Great Betrayal, and I read every word. And I had many a time to interview Ian Smith and see him socially over meals the last 20 years of his life, and read the book and asked him lots of questions. And the treachery, I first thought when I saw the title that I knew what he was talking about. Sure, the British betrayed us and the Americans. I had no idea about the betrayal of the National Party. The role that the South African, if the South African people had known how the National Party had betrayed Rhodesia in 1980, National Party would have been history. I mean, there was huge support for Rhodesia in South Africa. When I came down from Rhodesia, we still had news reels in the cinemas. At the cinema, they'd show news reels first. That's how a lot of people got their visual news. And whenever something came on of Rhodesia, there'd be applause throughout the cinemas. Now, some grandmother who'd fought off terrorists with her 303 rifle or something like that, and they ask if she's leaving. Why should I leave, you know? And a young 12-year-old boy with his 22 rifle in Umtali who fought off a group of AK-47-wielding terrorists from the second floor of their dorm as they were coming in to attack the school. And, you know, you'd get these different stories, and there was just huge support for Rhodesia. And there was always cheers. And the amount of people in Cape Town who had Stand Fast Rhodesia, Pray for Rhodesia, bumper stickers in their cars and so on. You could just tell the people in South Africa were very supportive of Rhodesia. If they had known how their government, the backstabbing National Party, were selling Rhodesia down the river. You know, I love South Africa, but the fact is, you can't betray your friends and expect God to stand by you when your turn comes. The South African government, I'm talking about the National Party government, betrayed Rhodesia, betrayed RENAMO, betrayed UNITA, betrayed 3-2 Battalion, betrayed Bushman's 201 Battalion, and then they betrayed all of us. And you take someone like de Klerk, he betrayed his wife, he betrayed his church, he betrayed his party, he betrayed his country, he betrayed his God on every level. President P.W. Botha of South Africa tried to warn the Southern population of the total war, which was targeting every aspect of life in South Africa. And while the mass media derided this total onslaught, history has proven P.W. Botha absolutely correct. We were under a total onslaught. South Africa is the superpower of Africa. We were a first world country in Africa. And we were in a continent deliberately set aflame by superpowers, especially Soviet Union and Red China. But unfortunately, the United States of America and Great Britain played a big role as well. Around our coast, you had these communist ships coming past. not just tankers, spy ships, like this Russian fishing trawler, like they have to come all the way from Russia to fish around the Cape of Good Hope, and warships, massive warships, like in Luanda Harbor. And here is the chief of the Warsaw Pact visiting Luanda, main harbor in Angola, to see how the war is going there. Here are Soviet ships offloading their equipment and Cuban troops in Luanda Harbor, and Soviet tanks in the streets of Luanda. And you can see they had their version of the Panga and the cogwheel and the communist star, instead of the hammer and the sickle, but it's saying the same thing, the peasants and the workers together to kill the others. Fidel Castro sent 650,000 troops to Angola. There were never less than 55,000 Cubans in Angola at any one time. His colony. Here's Uncle Fidel coming to see, you see the Cuban flag and the Angolan flag. Here's Agustin Nuneta, the drunken, psychotic Marxist poet who was running Angola at the time. And Fidel Castro was his overseer. He was the surrogate for the Soviet Union. And this was the sharp end of the Soviet southward offensive against South Africa. Communist missiles in Angola. MiGs, MiG-29s, extremely advanced weaponry, including of the East German Air Force, DDR, attacking our Parabats even. I was told how, from Colonel Breitenbach, he said, one day we saw two MiGs coming along, and they were in DDR paint, and East German camouflage. And one of the Parabats sent a heat-seeking missile straight up at one of them, and he said, however they knew, he didn't know, he said they did a flip, and another flip, facing down, the missile went straight over their heads, and it just unleashed all their missiles straight down. Took out the two Parabats who had sent up the missile at them. Never seen tactics like this before, he said. And they went off again, he said, we've never seen them in the skies before. And East German Air Force in Angola, what for? There's so much going on in Angola. They poured billions and trillions of dollars worth of weaponry into Angola. Now, this is an interesting picture, not our picture, taken by the commies, but picked up on a raid to Angola. There's Dos Santos. He replaced Agustin Nuneta after he died suddenly. These are two Russian commissars training SWAPO terrorists. Notice the Vietnamese flag there. Interesting, that Vietnamese flag there. Here's the Marx brothers, Vladimir Lenin, Karl Marx and Engels, the Three Stooges. And this is another very interesting picture. Now, this was actually taken by one of our people on a raid to Angola. You can see a Soviet P-76 amphibious weapon just outside, a South African officer and troopy. They've moved these pictures from the other side of the wall just to show you. There's Castro's picture. There's Brezhnev, dates it, 1970s. And you've got the SWAPO post. You've got Russian rank structures and some of the communist nonsense. The only thing that was done to set up this picture was moving these posters towards the door from the other side of the room. But this is just to show the Soviets were in Angola. The first multiple grenade launchers captured. In fact, Colonel Des Redmore analyzed these and made them known through Jane's Defense Weekly to the world. And these were in Angola, very advanced. And this already captured 1970s before they even turned up in Afghanistan. And on this basis, Colonel Des Redmore designed the Arms Corps multiple grenade launcher shoulder fired that could be an infantry support weapon, superior to this, which is just for static defense for around a base, for example. South Africa was subject to a total war where the South African Defense Force was spectacularly successful on the battlefield on the border of Southwest Africa. And in preemptive strikes into communist-controlled Angola, we absolutely hammered and slaughtered the Soviets, not just on the ground, but in the air. Dogfights, Russian MiG shot down, Hind helicopters. At one hostile press conference in Windhoek, Colonel Dion Ferreira, the operational commander of Operation Modular, Hooper and Packer, the three big ops at the end of the war, 87-88, he was challenged to respond to accusations that South Africa had just been beaten in the battles in Angola. And he reported tongue-in-cheek, if defeat for South Africa meant the loss of 31 men, 3 tanks, 5 armored cars, and 3 aircraft, then we lost. If victory for FAPLA, that's the MPLA army, and the Cubans meant the loss of 4,600 men, 94 tanks, 100 armored vehicles, 9 aircraft, and other Soviet equipment valued at more than R1 billion, then they won. I mean, you know, on any scoreboard, it's quite clear who won. Quite aside for the fact that Uncle Fidel Castro took his good buddy and friend, lifetime friend, Commander Sanja, who was the marshal in charge of all communist forces in Angola, put him against the wall and had him shot for treason for having lost the war in Angola to the fascist, colonial, racist running dogs of the South Africans. You don't execute victorious commanders. And all over Angola, you can today see the wreckage of the communists on the banks of the Lomba River. You can Google Earth, Lomba River, and you can see the Soviet tanks and armored cars still there. I mean, they're not going anywhere. These things are pretty permanent. They're going to be there probably till Jesus comes. And this is the kind of thing that you can Google Lomba River and see. South African Armored Battalion, 61 MEC, destroyed the cream of the Cuban MECNAS divisions, including the Presidential Guard, wiped them out on the banks of the Lomba River. As they called it, the last hot battle of the Cold War. When Vietnam and South Korea ended, Angola was the hottest part of the Cold War. Now, although we were super successful on the border, never lost a battle or a skirmish, the country was being undermined by subversion, sedition, and sabotage. And look at this ANC. This is an ANC poster, one of their propaganda ones. They sort of fancy the guys are dressed in some kind of overall uniforms, which I don't think we ever saw them in uniform, but anyway. But notice, they've also got a man in civilian outfits carrying a tire and a Molotov cocktail. So they're recognizing that the war is carried on not just by AK-47s and grenades, but by sheer terrorist tactics, the Nicholas murder. That's their own poster. We didn't make this. That's their poster. This is the butchery in Ondangwa, blown up by a limpet mine. St. James Church, 25 July. 1993, Pan-African Congress terrorists burst in, machine gun people. This is the Magoo Bar, Durban beachfront. Robert McBride, who became a police chief or commissioner or something like this, he murdered three women and killed and crippled others. For what? Bombing some bar on the beachfront in the Golden Mile? On the university campuses, in the classrooms, in the media, on the streets, insidious sedition subverted the public. Every day at UCT, every day at Wits, every day in the Argus, the Cape Times, the Star, the Rand Daily Mail, sedition, sedition, sedition. Everything it could do to undermine the country. The ANC was described in the 1988, and in fact I've also got the 1989, I think it's here too in our library, American Analysis of Communist Forces Worldwide, and the U.S. Analysis, that's Defense Intelligence Agency, described the African National Congress as the most spectacularly unsuccessful revolutionary movement in the world. So the ANC won a prize for something. No communist revolutionary movement worldwide achieved less than the ANC. They did not have a single military victory to their name in over 30 years of what they called the armed struggle. However, their allies in the South African Council of Churches, as you can see, had no problem campaigning under the Soviet banner. In the universities, editors of many newspapers, Hollywood, through sports boycotts, disinvestment campaigns, sanctions, general psychological warfare, economic warfare, political warfare waged by the Soviet bloc, and you may wonder about Hollywood, well, take even Lethal Weapon 2, where the original script had been Colombian drug dealers. They decided to make it South African embassy. Drug dealers, terrorists, bombers, counterfeiters. I mean, we're like Alison Ian kind of terrorists organization, all from the South African embassy in Los Angeles, no less. And if you knew the kind of wimpy, wet, weedy characters in foreign affairs that we had under Pick Boats at that time, yeah, it's strange credulity that they could have put up anything like that. But anyway. And in that, they were putting so much anti-South Africanism into the films right then, and they would be putting on, in the background, even on the Bill Crosby show, Free Nelson Mandela things, and what. They were just all the time at South Africa. the European Economic Community, the Organization for African Unity, the British Foreign Office, US State Department, the United Nations gradually wore down much of the southern population. Most people don't like being hated and despised and insulted. And so it wore people down. But I don't think that really made the big impact. But it was not the stick, it was the carrot. They got us to the point where the bulk of the southern population, not counting me, I voted no, were willing to settle for a negotiated settlement with the defeated ANC. The ANC was completely defeated. They weren't just defeated. Their sponsors had been smashed in Angola and were leaving the continent. The Cubans were leaving. They had no. The Cubans were leaving. The Russians were leaving. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989. The whole of the Iron Curtain collapsed. One communist dictatorship after another collapsed. The ANC was left high and dry. They no longer even had their backers and supporters. Soviets gone. Cubans gone. East Germany's gone. And by the way, Shishaba, the ANC's magazine, was always published in East Berlin by the Stasi and so on. They lost everything, even their publishers. And then F.W. de Klerk did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, resuscitate this worthless, failed organization. And why did the average Shadovkin buy this? Well, they trusted the National Party, who they didn't know how treacherous they were, but there was a big carrot. If we would vote yes in a referendum in 1992, which was a blank check, they would allow us to play cricket with Australians, rugby with the British, and we could participate in the Barcelona Olympics in 1992, although we couldn't have our own flag. We had to have this. So this is something of a carrot and a stick approach. The sticks were economic sanctions, disinvestment, boycotts, bans, riots, sabotage, bombing, sporadic acts of terrorism at home, increasing condemnation from abroad. I don't think any of that really affected the South Africans that much. I think the main thing that really affected us was we couldn't play international sports. I think that, you know, they could bomb us and curse us as much as they liked, and our arms corps made better weapons than the ones that they wouldn't let us buy anymore. And so I don't think all the sanctions did much, but the sports boycotts, that hurt. The carrots were the opportunity to participate in international rugby tours, cricket tours, 1992 Barcelona Olympics. They did a survey after the 1992 referendum, which was a bizarre referendum because we were basically giving a blank check to the National Party. They didn't give us, this is the constitutional arrangement we want, do you approve it? They just, do you approve of what we're still going to decide on? Which is, I was one of the 650,000 who said, no, or the Henom Stalikera, is he a mole? But the bulk did it. And when asked why, the bulk of South Africans who voted yes in the stupid referendum of 1992 was so that we could play cricket with the Australians and participate in the Barcelona Olympics. I mean, that's what it came down to. Betray the future for our children and grandchildren for a ball game. In PSYOPs, propagandists target adversaries by seeking to destroy, by psychological means, the morale and confidence of their targeted opponent to the extent that they begin to doubt the validity of their beliefs, their values, and actions. So when a person stops believing in the rightness and justness of their cause, now you're ready to beat them. That's what Sun Tzu said. The best way to defeat the enemy is not to fight him, but to get him to give up. Yuri Bezmenov, an ex-KGB operative, defected in 1984, and he explained the four stages of ideological subversion. Demoralization, destabilization, crisis, and normalization. He says it takes about 15 to 20 years to demoralize a population, because that's the amount of time it takes to move a generation through the education systems. And assuming you've infiltrated or subverted the education institutions, you can take that generation. Now, who's the generation burning and destroying things in the streets throughout North America? It's a generation that's gone through the indoctrination and so on. It always takes about 15 to 20 years before you can have the second stage of the revolution, because then you've got a generation that's been brought up with propaganda and indoctrination who is willing to burn and loot and kill and do whatever's got to be done out there. The highest art of warfare is not to fight at all, but to subvert anything of value in the country of your enemy until such time that the perception of reality of the enemy is screwed up to such an extent he does not perceive you as an enemy. You can take the enemy without a single shot being fired. Communists lose wars, but communists win subversion. They're not particularly good at fighting, but they're excellent at lying, deceiving, cheating, and subverting. And so he showed, this is from this KGB officer, how you demoralize people. Religion, education, media, and culture. You politicize religion. You commercialize it. You make it more entertainment, which is a death wish for any religion. Education, permissiveness, and relativity leads to an ignorant population. Called education, but basically ignorance and indoctrination. Media, you monopolize, manipulate, discredit anybody who's got another viewpoint, and you focus on non-issues. Make sure they don't understand real issues, so you've got an uninformed myopia. They know more and more, but less and less. Most important thing is scandals about Hollywood celebrities and sports stars, but you know, the real issues that affect your life and that of your grandchildren, don't worry about it. Structure of law and order, move it to more legislation, you know, the rules, totally disconnect from logic and morality. I mean, just think of lockdown regulations. What's this got to do with science, medicine, logic, or anything? But it doesn't matter. It's the law. No longer about justice. It's all about just. And so people start to mistrust us and don't believe it's even possible. Social relationships, ignore your obligations and your responsibilities. Focus on your rights. That'll create constant friction. Less individual responsibility. Security, well, they want to undermine the intelligence, police, and military to lead to a defenseless situation. Internal politics, they want party antagonisms, confuse, divide, and conquer. And then, as far as foreign issue goes, alienate people from their friends, from their isolate them. And of course, South Africa was isolated like no country in history has ever been isolated. Families, you want to break up the families. As Karl Marx said, we must break every tie of blood, soil, family, land, religion. Every tie must be broken down. And so it's not accidental that you see society on this implosion where families are broken up, churches are broken up, everything is broken up that holds society together. And of course, pulling down statues fits into that. Health, of course, make the people as sick as anything through junk food, make them enfeebled. Get them vaccinated, get them messed up, and so on. Race, well, what you've got to do is just get lots and lots and lots of hatred and division. Population, get the people off the land, move them into urbanization. Much easier to control people in the cities, because how could they enforce lockdown to people on the farms? You can't. But in the city, especially in apartment blocks, now you can control them. And of course, labor, mess everything up with unions and alienation and victimization. So, you go from demoralization to destabilization. Then there's a crisis. Doesn't matter what the crisis is. They'll make a crisis out of anything. Nothing. And then you have normalization while they consolidate and prepare for the next phase of the revolution. Now, modern mass communication techniques have now allowed unprecedented opportunity for foreign forces to engage in direct communication with the targeted enemy population. That was never possible before. Every country could control their own population because they control their own communications media. Now, foreign countries can have more influence on us. I saw this before, too. I remember in Rhodesia, we were Rhodesian. We knew some of what South Africans thought, but the Americans had no influence on us. The British had no influence on us. We had our own culture and our own character, and everyone you met was a friend. And there was this neighborliness, and I saw this in Southwest Africa as well. And when I came to South Africa, it was not quite the same cohesiveness because you were really under heavy American influence and you'd gotten TV in 1976 or so. And so you could see the American influence was starting to change South Africa's culture. And whereas before I was brought up, you could just go over to anybody's house and anyone could come over to your house and knock on the door and, you know, come straight in. Whereas now with TV, it's sort of, you've got to phone ahead, you've got to get permission, you've got to find out the people are there, that's convenient time, that doesn't interfere with the viewing. Used to do door-to-door evangelism. This became impossible after a while with TV because you'd be interfering with people's TV watching. And the prayer meeting got suspended in our church because it interfered with rich and poor man, and the world at war interfered with the men's group. And so right now, you've got everybody on earth can be reached by somebody in Los Angeles. You've no longer got your own cohesive people. Don't have control of their own children as much as some dress designer pervert in Paris and some Hollywood scriptwriter in Los Angeles. It's just weird that if people allow mass media into their home, it'll be that they're doing more babysitting and they've got more influence on your children than you do. In recent times, the internet has allowed for campaigns of disinformation and misinformation, including false flags and agent provocateurs to seek to discredit or character assassinate those whom they target. And there's no end of atrocities done to order. Every time a synagogue has a swastika painted on it, you can be absolutely sure this is done by the rabbi or one of his people. Every time somebody desecrates a mosque and they put a piece of bacon on the windowsill or something of a mosque, this is done by them in order to get sympathy and to try and discredit people in the area. The amount of fake atrocities and the amount of fake offenses. Agent provocateurs who will infiltrate a group, and we did this in the false flags, how the KGB infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan and said, how easy is this? You wear masks. You can infiltrate these guys easily. And they would do terrorist actions, the KGB would, and blame it on the Ku Klux Klan. Who would know? I mean, all wearing masks anyway. And, well, now we're all wearing masks. So how easy to do agent provocateurs now? Or they character assassinate those whom they don't like and they want to target. So if we lie to the government, it's a felony, but if the government lies to us, it's just politics. And they lie to us all the time. The Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism recognized that while World War I and the military defeat of Tsarist Russia provide a unique opportunity for the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, violent revolution was unlikely to succeed anywhere in Western Europe because they're just too Christian. Therefore, the Marxist leaders like Antonio Gramsci proposed the termite strategy to erode from the inside the cultural institutions of the West. And just as a termite could hollow out the inside of a wooden building so that fresh coats of paint on the outside of the building won't save the structure from collapsing in time, so too Marxists need to work for slow, gradual, long-term, culminative revolution, generational erosion, infiltrating the five culture-carrying, culture-transforming institutions of Western society, educational institutions. Has UCT been infiltrated by communism or what? News media, manufacturing consent, propaganda in the public mind. Do you know there was a time when they told you that it's good for you to smoke while you're pregnant? And, no flies in me thanks to DDT. And heroin hydrochloride, 2 to 3 to be taken per day. And let this magic material asbestos protect the buildings on your farm. That used to be the media, yeah? They manufacture consent. Whenever there's a big story in the media, look for the story, the real story, the real news behind news that they're trying to distract you from. The tail wagging the dog. The entertainment industry. The scriptures, I'll set no wicked thing before mine eyes. There's a lot of wicked things being thrown at people from it. ETV, evil TV. Religious institutions, boy, have they been hijacked. I was in an evangelism explosion international conference in St. George's Cathedral, right here downtown Cape Town. And good people, outstanding. I mean, EE's top class. But because they were being hosted there, the local dean organized, he first greeted them with a Muslim greeting, which I recognized immediately straight from the Quran. And then he had the choir come and sing with fist in the air praises to Nelson Mandela before handing over to them to run their Evangelical Explosion Conference. Now, as guests, they had no easy recourse to complain, but it was such an abuse of the host who was charging them a fortune to hire the venue to abuse a cathedral in that way. But I've seen worse than that. In this cathedral, back in the 1980s, when Desmond Tutu was the arch heretic in charge, he invited the man who wrote The Myth of God Incarnate. I just forget his name for a moment. The Myth of God Incarnate. Mega heretic, and had him preaching from behind this eagle pulpit that just as the church managed to survive learning that the earth isn't the center of the universe and the walls are not flat, not that anyone in the Bible ever believed that, and that Mary wasn't a virgin, and that there's no Trinity, we'll survive knowing that Jesus isn't part of the Trinity and there's no Trinity and Jesus was a normal man born of a woman out of wedlock. And it's bad enough that this man spoke this garbage from there. But out comes the Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Oh, thank you, my brother, for these wonderful insights from God. And, oh, God bless you, you've blessed us. And then the people applaud, and some people say amen. It's bad enough to have an idiot speaking heresy, but to have it applauded. You sort of wonder what's going on. Are the people just so hyper-polite they don't want to say, what a lot of nonsense. But have our political institutions been infiltrated? We've now got governments owned by corporations, run by psychopaths, lying about imaginary economies based on debt, fueled by legal wars, destroying ecosystems, poisoning food and water, decreasing education, that is spectacular, increasing prisons, manipulating the media, foreclosing on homes, suppressing free energy, technology, making us struggle, starving, humiliating, and killing the world. Yet you stay silent and follow the pathological culture, pay your taxes, vote, and trust the government. That's a fair summary. The slogan of Gramsci was, capture the culture. After World War I, one of Woodrow Wilson's propagandists, Edward Bernays, who ran the Committee for Public Information, which turned America from being 90% anti-intervention to being 90% pro-war, even lynching people like the poor Amish pastors who didn't want to get involved in Europe's war. After the war, Edward Bernays, who, by the way, was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, he started public relations, PR, PR being the first two letters of propaganda. So he started the whole concept of PR, public relations, but it started with, he has taken propaganda to the commercial. Now, the government didn't need him anymore. The war was over. So he went to the tobacco company. He actually went to Lucky Strike and said, I can double your sales. And they said, how could you double our sales? He said, by getting women to smoke. There's no way women are going to smoke. He said, you pay me X amount and I'll get women to smoke. And he hired some of the most glamorous models, got them to march in Easter parades and so on smoking, made sure the journalists got pictures of this, commissioned key photographers to make them look very glamorous and to make it look like smoking is a glamorous thing, and he managed to change the whole stigma of society against smoking, and he caused them torches of freedom. And so, how do you like this for subtle? Light a Lucky and you'll never miss the sweets that make you fat. How's that for subtlety? And so, an ancient prejudice has been removed. American intelligence, and all this, you know, the ancient prejudice against cigarettes. And so basically, talking about why letting women smoke, this is torture of freedom. I'm sure women getting lung cancer and dying early was great liberation. This is another one of his classics. 20,679 physicians. This is totally sucked out of his thumb. There's no such survey done. Say Lucky's are less irritating as Tosin. Your throat irritation protection against irritation against coughing. So he made up with a doctor advising you smoke Lucky Strikes. In fact, my mother says she remembers that. That, you know, adverts were saying doctors recommend smoking. It's good for you. It's good for your health. It's good for your lungs. You need this throat protection too. Only a cigarettes can make. So here he's saying if you're on the radio, you need to smoke cigarettes so that you've got this throat protection. Okay, we know that's totally insane, but people bought this. And of course, what can unite you better than sharing lung cancer together? So, you know, there's all these sort of things. Notice his book on propaganda by Edward Bernays. It's a target, and who's in the target? A woman smoking. And by the way, her teeth won't look like that if she smokes. But anyway, we live in a world that's made up of fake people, fake food, fake medicine, fake weather, fake news, fake history, fake pandemics, fake revolution, fake spirituality. And you wonder why people hate the truth. Herbert Marcuse, another of the Frankfurt School Marxists, buddy of Antonio Gramsci, emphasized the importance of subverting the culture through obscenity, blasphemy, perversion, and pornography. He advocated use swear words like verbal grenades to attack bourgeois Christian society. Bring it to the arts, bring it to the sciences, bring it to music. Obscenity and blasphemy are weapons in psychological warfare to break down Christian civilization. Remember, the biggest obstacle to communism taking over Europe is Christianity. Break down Christianity. And so you have people now who think that blasphemous statements like if only Mary had had an abortion, and that that's acceptable. And yet, pastors and evangelists could be harassed and prosecuted for preaching what the Word of God teaches in Romans 1 concerning the sin of homosexuality. This is now considered hate speech, but that's not. That's not offensive, but this is offensive. Christ can set you free is offensive. By the way, you know what's most attacked in our book on the Pink Agenda and the Rise of the Gay GB? It's the last part of the book. It's a testimony of a homosexual who came to Christ. That offends them more than anything. They don't want to be told that you can be set free. They want to say you're born with it or it's your choice. And, there's nothing they hate more than a testimony of a homosexual who's been set free by Christ. Now, Hubert Marcuse, this man who is promoting repressive tolerance. In his 1965 paper, Repressive Tolerance, Hubert Marcuse proposed setting up a victim coalition of people who could be convinced that they were oppressed. Didn't matter if they were workers, women, young, old, employees, whatever. This cadre of people could become the new proletariat to accomplish the long march through the institutions. These new oppressed could be brainwashed into thinking that their oppressors were biblical Christians. Now, these are his words. This strategy included casting biblical Christians as narrow-minded bigots, who by nature racist, xenophobes, homophobes, Islamophobes, misogynists, and greedy. And so you're offending our feelings, and the rights of others are offensive. We demand you restrict them. These are SJWs, social justice warriors. And of course, big business, big government, and the military-industrial complex are thrilled at any excuse to increase their power and limit the powers of others. So these people in the streets don't realize they're actually useful idiots. They think they are liberators, but actually they're just expendable cannon fodder for increasing totalitarian dictatorship and control of others. And if you disagree, you're a racist, bigot, hater, homophobe, Nazi, anti-Semite, and all the rest of it. You know, I mean, no words are too bad to throw at someone who disagrees with him. And so the left has become tolerant leftists beating people up in the name of having a hate-free zone. So you use hate and intolerance because you want a society free of hate and intolerance. And all of this, I'm still quoting from Hubert Marcuse, all of this would be definitional of what it means to have white privilege. This new proletariat is taught the wonders of tolerance for everyone except Christians, against whom intolerance must be practiced at every turn. I'm quoting from Hubert Marcuse. You've got to have it that anyone can say anything, but not anything Christian, because they're the biggest problem. In his 1965 paper, Marcuse gave the justification for this new intolerance. Liberating tolerance then would mean intolerance against movements from the right and tolerance for movements from the left. We have no enemies to the left. All of our enemies are to the right. You have got to shut down any opinion from the right, and you've got to encourage anything from the left. As to the scope of this tolerance and intolerance, it would extend to the stage of action as well as discussion and propaganda of deed as well as word. This is such an important point. Propaganda is not just words. Propaganda is actions. Marches are propaganda. Life trains are propaganda. Marches to parliament. Prayer vigils outside the gates of parliament. That's propaganda. We use propaganda too. I mean, propaganda is not a bad word. It can be used for good. It can be used for ill. Justin Trudeau, who must be the worst leader in the Western world right now, has said the worst part of Canadian society are Christians. As R.J. Rossini warned us years ago, toleration is a device to introduce a new law system as a prelude to a new intolerance. In the name of tolerance, they have exercised greater intolerance than has ever been seen before. C.S. Lewis of Cambridge University said, of all the tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victim may be the most oppressive. It may be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep. His cupidity may at some point be satiated, satisfied. But those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. Think the Corans, the snitches, the neighborhood spies for the Stasi and KGB who report someone who's walking their dog during a lockdown. Think of the people who phone the police to arrest someone who's surfing. And think of the BLM rioters and the Antifa characters. These people who are so convinced of their moral superiority, they are the worst kind of oppressors, according to C.S. Lewis. Interesting, he saw that in the 1940s. Did you notice when Antifa took over 6 blocks of Seattle, the first thing they did was build a wall? And then they want to see ID, and they want to charge whites to enter, sort of like hypocrisy rule, and ban guns while they stood there with guns. And then they would contact their mother to send them everything, because can you include vegan, soya-free, and so on, because they were starving. They need foreign aid by day 2. I don't know, are they still operational, these creeps and chop or chairs? From chairs to chop. Inspired by the French Revolution, I presume. Chop, yeah. Now, this Kamala Harris is a serious candidate for being vice president of the next presidential candidate for the Democratic Party. Biden's most likely going to get it. We don't know. Democrats are still out on that one. But look at what she said. Kamala Harris. Once Trump's gone and we have regained our rightful place in the White House, look out if you supported him and endorsed his actions. Whose actions? Trump's. Because we'll be coming for you next. You will feel the vengeance of a nation. No stone will be left unturned as we seek you out in every corner of this great nation, for it is you who've betrayed us. Can you believe that people talk like that? Now, it used to be democracy is a good idea, different opinions are a good idea, and even if you disagree with the person, you allow them the right to have another opinion, and people can vote for other parties. I know people in the Netherlands who say, if anyone at work knew, I'm talking about teachers, policemen, civil servants, if they knew that I voted for Geert Wilders' Freedom Party, I'd lose my job. And yet it's one of the biggest parties in the country. There's millions of Netherlands people vote for Geert Wilders' Freedom Party, but they can't let anyone know that they voted for it or they'd lose their job. It's insane. And now it's getting that way in America. People are being attacked for wearing a Make America Great Again hat or a Trump slogan or things like this. They're attacking people. People have lost their jobs because their wife made a tweet critical of BLM. Truth is a new hate speech. During a time of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. They don't want you to have free speech, so they invent the term hate speech. Hate speech is just, it's the modern equivalent of heresy or treason, which used to get you burned at the stake or have your head chopped off in the Middle Ages. So now it is hate speech. It's just a way of shutting up dissent, that's all. Karl Marx declared the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. And George Orwell observed the most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their own history. So those who understand Marxism, particularly the cultural Marxism of the Frankfurt School, the Gramsci strategy, the role of Obsentia and Marcuse's revolutionary strategy, will immediately recognize where the violence and the campaign to topple statues and monuments come from, and to spray obscenities on the walls. Where's this coming from? Marcuse, Frankfurt School. And it's straight out of Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution. The public humiliation, shaming, apology scenes were exactly what Mao Zedong publicly shamed and sidelined, humiliated tradition leaders in China's revolution. They would take the teachers, the priests, the ministers, the journalists, the leaders, the mayors, all the people who had some respectability in the community, and they'd publicly humiliate them, have the people swear and scream and shout at them, they'd film it, there's a big television camera sometimes, force them to stand on there with their hands tied behind their backs, bowing, with all kinds of evil things accused on them, counter-revolutionary, reactionary, black marketeer, anything like that. An evangelist would be a counter-revolutionary. A black marketeer could be a Bible smuggler. A revolutionary or counter-revolutionary could be someone who said, things were better before the revolution, or I'm hungry. You know, that would be reactionary and counter-revolutionary. These public shaming ceremonies were major parts of the second phase of the revolution in Russia and in China, but most spectacularly in China. And this country is very inspired by China. And the whole lockdown is inspired by China. And what are they doing in America right now with bowing before BLM? Well, remember George Orwell, who used to be a policeman and then was a propagandist in the British propaganda department during the Second World War, and then he wrote the book Animal Farm, and then he wrote 1984. And he spoke of newspeak and thought police and thought crimes, where opponents would be vaporized, made unpeople, and disappear down the memory hole. I don't think he could have foreseen how Zuckerberg could do that. Just gone, vaporized. Aldous Huxley warned us in his prophetic book, Brave New World, of a future sophisticated society where people are distracted by endless entertainment stimulation, subdued by drugs, to be easily manipulated by the New World Order state. Brave New World. They all sort of look like they just got drugs and now look like tablet capsules on their heads. Aldous Huxley. Yes, his brother was the famous evolutionist. John Dewey, one of the authors of the Humanist Manifesto in 1933, was a pioneer of secular humanist state education. Now, we should be able to recognize how much of the entertainment industry defiles us and degrades us. Marcusian. How much of the news media discourages us and distracts us. How much of this is news and how much is just views and propaganda? The new mass media is not informing us as much as distracting us and defiling us. Disinforming us. Disinformation. Media control is a spectacular achievement of propaganda. The first victim of war, they've said, is truth. And remember, we are at war. It's a cultural war. It's a war for truth. It's a battle for the mind. So much in the society today, including the music and arts, depresses and disgraces us. Through the Stockholm Syndrome, many are cowed into codependency on their very abusers. And there's a church I've had services in. I've run a biblical worldview seminar there. A pastor friend. And he advertised on social media. He tagged me too, asking for 50 white Christians to come and stand behind a Black Lives Matter poster. And, he didn't seem to get 50. But anyway, he did get national news and SATV sent cameramen there and so on. And he tagged me on a whole lot of things saying that I should preach on Black Lives Matter. Well, I have. Cultural Marxism has deteriorated society. Critical race theory, which is a Frankfurt School idea, has divided society, confused, divide, and conquer. So you know you're living in a brainwashed society when white people are protesting against white people for being white people. I mean, how bad is that? This is not driven by black people. It's driven overwhelmingly by white people. And you know, even the Blackland Party, of Blackland, what's it, Black First, Land First, it's run by some car in Hermanus who's running around, some white woman who's manipulating them. The whole slucking a sheep on Clifton, it was all organized, and she's there, this car, controlling the whole thing. And so often, just like Joe Slover behind Nelson Mandela and so on, you've got some whitey pulling the strings, often on this sort of thing. They find it useful to have a black face in front, but the people behind are probably working for the banksters. Most of Hollywood entertainment degenerates and degrades. The Gramsci turmoil strategy has corrupted and rotted most of the institutions of the West. And if you've watched the Agenda film, you recognize this. This is the master diagram that showing the links of all the different, from Karl Marx through the John Deweys and the Saul Alinskys and Herbert Marcuse, all the way up, and how it's morphed into the modern-day Democratic Party in the USA, which is, they might as well call it the Communist Party of USA now. In fact, here's a bit of homework. You can go on the SA votersguide.com website, our website, which has got live links on each of the logos to the different parties. And if you click on the ANC's logo, what you find on the homepage is a link to the Southern Communist Party. You go onto the Southern Communist Party's website, and what does it say? Southern Communist Party is not putting up candidates in the next election, but advise all cadres to vote for the ANC. Interesting. Oh, and by the way, you can buy linen baseball caps, linen t-shirts, linen ballpoint pens, and credit cards accepted. These and so on. Seems a bit capitalist to me. But wait a minute, there's a link to the Communist Party USA on the Communist Party South Africa. I go to the Communist Party USA website, and what does it say? Well, they're also selling baseball caps of linen and Marx and t-shirts and ballpoint pens and mugs, and there's a whole range of things, bumper stickers. And they also accept credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, all that stuff. And then what do they have? Communist Party USA is not putting up a candidate in the next election, but advises all cadres to vote for the Democratic Party candidate. Now, when the Communist Party says, we're not putting up a candidate, vote for those guys, what does that tell you? They control them. the Marcusian Subvert and Conquer the Culture campaign has been so successful, not only is perversion now tolerated, it's promoted and celebrated. South Africa used to have the most conservative laws on the planet. South Africa's the one place in the world no homo dared let anyone know that he was. Boy, he was in the closet or he was in deep trouble. Seriously in the closet. Quiet. Pornography was illegal. Obscenity was illegal. Blasphemy was edited out of films. No abortion, no pornography, no blasphemy, no perversion. And today, we've got one of the most liberal constitutions in the world promoting all these things by government policy. Degenerate entertainment, defiled art, decadent culture is part of the strategy of cultural Marxists to rot the soul of a nation. So we're seeing communism in the classroom, and we're seeing a war on our historic monuments in the streets. Here's a whole lot of D's. Discouragement, distraction, depression, dependency, deterioration, division, degeneration, degradation, disintegration, all equal defeat. This is their psychological warfare campaign. Our cities are on fire because our churches aren't on fire. When you get down to this isn't just the wickedness of the wicked, it's the weakness and inactivity and neutrality and passivity of God's people that's allowed it to take place. So, most important, how do we respond to Marxist bullying tactics? We resist them. There's nothing communists respect more than strength. There is nothing they despise more than weakness. When the police don't stop, when the police stand back, when the police are told to stand down, when the mayor and the police chief apologize and tell the police not to, what does it do? Do you see any fear for the police here or any respect for them? This is in Athens, in Greece. Where's the respect or fear for the police? We could not imagine this happening when we grew up. We respected the police and the army, and they wouldn't have put up with any rubbish either. This is in Athens. Police being set on fire. And these people think that by washing the feet of mobsters, gangs, protesters, BLM, that they can calm the situation by bowing to the mob, washing their feet or brushing or kissing their boots. Literally. Have you ever seen anything like this before? Not only figuratively, but literally, they are bowing to the mob. They have no idea that all they're doing is greatly aggravating the situation and encouraging the revolutionaries to demand far, far more. Really and truly. This is in Sweden. This policewoman has been, suspended, and she's under investigation. She knelt in front of the mob and put white silence is violence. And then she raised the clenched fist Communist Party salute worldwide. For the first time in history, members of Congress bowed. Now, they didn't bow to God. They didn't take a knee to remember soldiers who've died in war, remember the millions of babies who've died with their taxpayers' money and Planned Parenthood. None of that. They bowed to the BLM mob, apparently in some kind of respect for George Floyd. Is he the only person whose death has any significance or meaning? And as for these weird colored things, I think they somehow think that's African, but I don't know any African who wears anything like that. But I suppose somebody managed to sell them something and they believed it. In my experience, it's absolutely essential that one never gives Marxist bullies or mobs a millimeter. If you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. You give them your finger, they'll take your whole arm. Being brought up in war-torn Rhodesia, experiencing terrorism and revolution, working communist Angola, Mozambique and Sudan, being imprisoned in Zambia and Mozambique, and in many other cases I've seen, the more steadfastly and strongly you stand, the better. The moment Marxists sense weakness or fear or compromise, they smell blood and they will howl for more. They'll escalate the unreasonable demands. It's never enough. Never. Example. Colonel Jan Breitenbach. Legend. One of the first of the Parabats. Leader of the biggest airborne assault ever, Kasinga. 1978. Parachuted in on SWAPO headquarters in Angola. Wiped them out. Colonel Breitenbach with bandaged hand in the middle of this. This is the old Parabats when they're still using World War II type webbing. Before we start to get that really mod stuff that we got in 1980. Eagle Strike, that's the story of the airborne assault on Kasinga. biggest airborne assault ever. Colonel Breitmach founded 3-2 Battalion. He was a recce, one of the first recces. He went into Angola. He recruited thousands of Portuguese-speaking black Angolan ex-communists, in many cases, FAPLA, FNLA, and he forged them in battle into a mighty force, fighting for South Africa. South Africa's Foreign Legion, the 3-2 Battalion. Now, there were some Rhodesians in there. There were South Africans, recces and so on, Parabats, and thousands of Angolans who were fighting for South Africa. And they fought hard, and they killed a lot of commies. They had a massive kill count, and I think they lost more men in action than any other South African unit. 3-2, the terrible ones. And I must say, they were probably terrible, and they can be grateful for the white South African Rhodesian officers who probably saved many a terrorist from a terrible fate if they'd been left to their Angolan ex-communist friends. And, well, anyway, Colonel Breitmach, who founded all these, when he retired from the army, he joined Frontline Fellowship, 1988. From 1988 to 1994, he was part of every one of our camps, courses, guest speaker, trained our people, tracking, anti-tracking. January and February 1989, we went into Southwest Africa on Operation Air, and we preached in every base, one side of the Sector 10 to the other, preached them in the fields, ministered to every unit possible, and Colonel Breitmach was just outstanding to travel with, and so for 30 days I was in the sleeping bag next to Colonel Breitmach every day, sometimes in the field. That was my pivot, and we were kitted out, and here we were just like a kilometer from Angola. And to hear Colonel Breitmach preach, I mean, he preached hard. He knew the sins of everyone. He named names. He had everyone from the general, General Meyring, as head of SWA TF at the time, and everyone else squirming, because he is as merciless a preacher of the gospel as he is a soldier in the field. Well, after we preached all the way through Sector 10, the day came when Colonel Breitmach and I, we were just a few days from the end of our operation, and we got up one morning. As I woke up, looked over, and Colonel was already awake, and he said, "Peter, let's walk into Angola and preach to the communists." And he talked his friends into lending us a Puma. We flew to three different places where there was joint monitoring commission. It was a ceasefire at the time. And there's a whole bunch of Cubans and commies on the one side and our guys on the other side. And we walked in. We preached. We'd land on the South African side, walk into Angola at each of these points. You can see some people didn't use visas to enter on previous occasions. And this is one of a few pictures of the day. There's the colonel sitting back. Here's a 3-2 Battalion chap translating for us. And we preached hard and heavy within sound of many commies. We were surrounded by these commies. They stand there fingering the AKs, the RPGs, the PKMs, others, Tokaros, and SKSs. And Colonel Breitmach stood up and said, "My name is Colonel Jan Breitmach of 3-2 Battalion. My men and I, we killed thousands of you communists. Thousands. We never had any trouble killing you. Our problem was catching you. You ran so fast. You spineless, yellow-bellied cowards. You ran. Even when you outnumbered us 10-1, you outdistanced Buffles. You would have won Olympic records. You ran away from the fight. You were scared to die, and you should be, if you knew what was waiting for you on one side or the other side of the grave." But he said, "Why are you so afraid to die? Your God is Karl Marx. Your religion is atheism. Your commissars are the priests of Satan. You're all damned. You're lost. You're doomed. You're going to burn in hell forever. If you knew what was waiting for you one second the other side of the grave, you'd crawl across the minefield and beg 3-2 Battalion to show you the way of salvation, Jesus Christ." Now, I'll never forget these words. It's burned into my memory. I remember my hand going to my Browning high power on my hip and thinking, the colonel wants a short way to glory. We're not going to see the sunset today. I thought I'd be with the Lord before the end of that day. And yet we got away with it not once, but twice and three times. Preached to the commies. And you know, they didn't do a thing. They just all stood there. They outnumbered us massively. I mean, all we had was a couple of nangles. And they just were silent. This confronting communists with the gospel, one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. Everything of that day is just burned into my memory, and because it was so shocking. And the commies heard. In fact, apparently many of them went into psychological troubles, and they had to be pulled away from the front, and they had to bring commissars up there, and they had to bring choirs, and they had to, they said their morale was shattered from our evangelism, so much so that they went crying to Pik Border. And by the time we got home that night to Ruakona base, the commandant came out and said, "Oh, Colonel, the lines have been humming today from Fort Rakoota to the Bastion." The Bastion was HQ in Bintok, and to Sector 10, that's Ndangwa. And Pik wants you and Hammond out of Southeast Africa by tomorrow. Out of the territory totally. So the rest of the meetings are cancelled. And he said, the OC said, "What the hell is Breytenbach and Hammond up to? Are they trying to restart the war?" And so we were evicted. And Colonel Breytenbach had fired the first shots of the war back at, was it Umbalatu, and attacked a SWAPO terrorist camp. So he, more than anyone else, had fought for the freedom of Southwest Africa, and he got evicted from it for preaching the gospel to the communists and hurting their feelings. Well, when I marched 30,000 people to Parliament in Cape Town to oppose President Nelson Mandela's secular state policies, I was summoned to the President's mansion. I mean, we marched down Adderley Street. We swamped Parliament. We made a strong stand against the secular state. And you see this man just to the right there. This was the man sent from the President's office to receive our petition. So this man gave me the summons. "Madiba wants to see you." So it was Tuesday, we marched Thursday at Canaandal, which is Kruiskeer, the President's mansion. So I went there. The first words Nelson Mandela said to me was, "So, Mr. Hammond, what were you doing during the years of struggle?" I said, "I was fighting people like you, sir." And Nelson Mandela smiled, he laughed, he stood up, he shook my hand, and he said, "I'm so glad to meet an honest white man. All the whites I've met so far, they all tell me how they always support me and always oppose apartheid. I wondered how the National Party had stayed in power for 44 years when all the whites actually opposed the National Party and supported me." So my response was, "Well, make no mistake, Mr. President, we were not fighting for apartheid. We were fighting against communism and terrorism." His response, "Apartheid was the greatest evil in the history of the world." My response, "I couldn't agree with you, Mr. President. That prize must go to your friends and supporters, the communists." Like Fidel Castro, who he had just given the biggest medal South Africa can give and had him address a joint sitting of our parliaments in Cape Town. Fidel Castro and Nelson were serious buddies. And, of course, Nelson Mandela has said nothing but good things about all the communist mass murderers. I said, "They have littered the 20th century with 160 million corpses, not foreign people killed in times of war by invaders, but their own people killed by their own government in times of peace." I quoted from Black Book Communism and Death by Government, Professor Rommel. "And over 66 million people slaughtered under communism in the Soviet Union. And over 69 people murdered in Red China." And the exchange went on. I gave the stats on, here you can see the death toll just in the Soviet Union. Over 20 million just in the 1930s alone. The expansion of communism right down to Mozambique and Angola. Here you've got from Operation World, Patrick Johnson's, the death toll in the 20th century, 275 million non-combatant deaths by governments in the 20th century, mostly by the communists. The rise of communist nations right up to 1989 when they lost, like almost every communist country in the world fell in 1989 to 1991. Nelson Mandela then said to me, sort of stared in the ceiling and drifted off into memory lane, said, "When I was a prisoner of the Boers in Robben Island, they wouldn't allow me to wear sunglasses. My eyes are very sensitive." That's interesting because this picture you get all over the place there of Nelson Mandela looking off the garden on Robben Island with sunglasses. So they must have let him have sunglasses somewhere, but anyway, maybe they didn't for the first year or something, I'm not sure. So I said, "Well, my eyes are also very sensitive, Mr. President, and I can understand how unpleasant and painful it must have been, but that doesn't quite compare with the kind of atrocities documented in Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago." And of course, he has pals with all these people. He has pals with Che Guevara. He was trained by the Cubans in both Ethiopia and in Algeria. He organized the armed struggle. He launched it. He initiated it. Umkhonto Sizwe was his brainchild, without the permission of the ANC leadership, by the way. So at one point, Nelson Mandela expressed the surprise that we were wanting to restrict the rights of women by opposing abortion. I responded, Mr. President, you are questioning the Christianity of people who 40 years ago justified apartheid. I tell you, sir, it will not be 40 years from now and people will question your humanity for legalizing abortion. You are seeking to replace apartheid with abortion, and abortion is worse than apartheid. Abortion does not just place the baby on a separate voter's roll and restrict where they can live or swim. Abortion takes the baby's life. Life begins at conception. Abortion is the violent taking of that life. Abortion is the worst type of apartheid. It separates a baby from its mother and from its life support at a most crucial stage of development. You're seeking to replace discrimination on the basis of race with discrimination on the basis of age. History will judge you seriously. Well, at the end of the hour, Nelson Mandela stood up and said, you may take your pictures now. I mean, the clock literally struck an hour. I mean, walked in on an hour, closed an hour. And I didn't mean to be rude, but honestly, I hadn't even thought about that, and I hadn't brought a camera, and it was the last thing on my mind. Well, what can I do with a picture of me with Nelson Mandela? So I said, no, thank you. And he stopped, and he turned, and his mouth dropped, and he looked absolutely stunned. Maybe we were the first delegation to meet with him who didn't want their pictures taken with them. And then I hastened, but we would like to pray with you. And he said, no, no, that's very private, that's personal. I pretended not to hear. I put a hand on his one shoulder, and Dumini Soon even said, put a hand on the other shoulder. And we prayed that the Lord would not grant Mr. Mandela one any peace until he did what he knew what was right, until he introduced legislation for the protection of helpless, innocent babies from the violence and injustice of abortion. And I prayed that Nelson Mandela would find peace with Christ by bowing the knee and surrendering to Almighty God to do his will. And at the end of our impassioned prayer, I handed over a book from Dr. James Kendi. And Mr. Mandela thanked us, but he's calm, but I think he's steaming inside. And he assured, he said, I'm always responsive to the concerns of your constituency. My door is always open, Mr. Hammond, if you've got any other concerns. Now, that was Thursday. We marched on Tuesday. Thursday, we met with him. Monday morning, two senior investigators, the Inland Revenue Service, SARS, Southern Revenue Service, knocked on our door at our Harlequin Mission House and began a seven-year audit. I went back 6 years, I continued for 7 years. We had 13 years of our finances, family, personal, audited. And the lawyer we got in to help us in account said they've never seen anything like it. I said, you're a small operation. I said, these guys normally deal with $100 million operations. This is, I mean, your budget's nothing. For the, it's not much now, but it was even less back in 1994, five. And they didn't give up. They carried on. So Nelson Mandela was very pleasant, very polite, very charismatic, and he put his dogs on us. On another occasion, 1995, I was summoned to Parliament to give a submission to the subcommittee on draft publications bill, which effectively legalized pornography and blasphemy. After my submission, which was held in the old chamber, this is the old Assembly's chamber, you can see by the green seats and so on, it was in this house where Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd was murdered by communist stefunders. Well, during my submission, of course, it wasn't full. There was only about 50 members of Parliament there. That was back in the days when they were all there because it's all so exciting and new. Now you'd be lucky to get a quorum. Those of us giving submissions were on this side and the parliamentarians on the other side. And during question time, one ANC MP asked me, have you ever apologized for what you did in the SADF? I said, you want me to apologize for what I did in the South African Defence Force? I'm sorry we didn't kill all of you. You were not freedom fighters. You were terrorists. You didn't attack our military bases. You attacked civilians, black civilians. With the necklace murder, you burned over 1,000 black South Africans with a brutal necklace murder. You planted landmines in dirt roads and killed whole families. You planted landmines in roads leading to schools and killed school children coming in school bus on their way to school. You kidnapped young children from schools, took them across the border and brutalized them and trained them for your terrorist groups. You murdered many. You raped the girls. You threw hand grenades through windows into black policemen's homes at night. You petrol bombed the homes of black town councillors, car bombs, limpet mines, blatant targeted civilians. You are hypocrites. I mentioned the Church Street bombing. how many civilians killed there. Just think of these are the weapons. We used to have these up in every shopping center, by the way. These are the weapons terrorists. Not only do they come from the Soviet Union, but notice the weapons. Landmines and limpet mines. Grenades. That was their weapons. Documented in the history of communism in South Africa, the African National Congress is just a front organization for the Southern Communist Party. I was still saying to him, you speak against racism, and then you laugh and applaud and give standing ovations to the worst racist on the planet today, Robert Mugabe, dictator of Zimbabwe, who is brutalizing his own people, who is savagely crushing all dissent and freedom of speech in their country. You have no right to ever speak against racism when you obviously applaud, endorse, and enthusiastically practice racism. I'm sorry we ended the war before thoroughly and completely eradicating every last one of you communists. And there was a stunned, awkward silence for a time, and then the chairman said, right, let's move on to the next point. And they never brought up the subject again, and nobody's ever asked me for an apology again. That is the only way you can deal with communists. Guilt manipulators, gaslighters, thugs, and terrorists. I'm sorry we didn't kill all of you. That's the apology they're going to get from me. I'm really sorry we didn't finish the war by finishing them. Napoleon observed that he could not believe the foolishness of King Louis XVI in not ordering his men to open fire on the mob. They were going to kill him and his wife, and they did. Young Napoleon, a young lieutenant, seeing the massacre of the King's Swiss Guard, determined that if he ever faced a mob, he would give them the whiff of grape shot, which is like a shotgun out of a cannon. We put a whole lot of little balls in and turn the cannon, the artillery on them. This is exactly what Napoleon did on the 5th of October, 1795, just a few years later, which led to Napoleon becoming a leader in France, won the directorate, won the three leaders, and then he later became the emperor. Napoleon Bonaparte was adamant, you cannot reason with a mob. And throughout history, it's been understood that the only way to deal with arsonists or looters is to shoot them. And by the way, you don't have to do it a lot, you just have to do it once. And then there would be no more. But when you tolerate it, it expands. And the worst thing you can do is tell police to stand by while lives and property are destroyed in front of them. Those who advise police to stand back or stand down during threats to life and property are unraveling the very foundations of civilization. There could be nothing worse than mob rule anarchy. We need to understand the agenda behind the defund the police. The BLM plan to defund the police does not mean a police-free state. Marxists want control. They're not going to give up control. But defund the police means defund this police. Why this police? Because they're professional. They're mostly conservative. They support Donald Trump. It's all about 2020 being an election year in America. And so their plan is to defund and disarm and disband the organized professional police force as it now exists, which is mostly fairly conservative, generally pro-Trump. What they then want to do is have their warlords or gangs replace the existing police force with BLM and Antifa revolutionaries in police uniform. Just like what happened in the Soviet Union under Trotsky with the Cheka, Dzerzhinsky starting the Cheka, which became the NKVD, which became the KGB. They closed down the Krana, the Tsarist police, and they opened up the Cheka, which became the NKVD and the KGB. Just like the Cultural Revolution. When they disbanded the police in China, that didn't mean there's no more police. And now they've got the Red Guards take their place. This would be followed by gun confiscations, and you know where this ends. And by the way, what happens in Africa where you've got warlords running? Do you think when you've taken away the professional police and you've now got the warlords running that you now get more peace, that you get more law and order, that people's rights are more respected? This is what happens when you have the warlords run the show. The issue is never the issue. The issue is the revolution. Like the French Revolution in 1789. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917. The Cultural Revolution in China. How many more times must we see this agenda worked out before people understand what Curtis Bauer documented in this agenda, Master of Deceit, and so true? The issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. They don't care about the issue. It's just a pretext. We need to understand the times, and we need to know what God's people should do. History matters. Truth matters. We need to get back to the Bible, and we need discernment. We need to disconnect from the world indoctrination, distraction, and disinformation media. We need to support independent alternative sources of news media. We need to support independent alternative sources of entertainment. Exercise discretion. Consult Movie Guide. Know before you go. MovieGuide.org. George Orwell said, "Journalism is printing what someone else does not want printed. Everything else is just public relations." Now that's so true. A good journalist should write without fear or favor. If you write what people want, then you're just a public relations officer. A good journalist writes what people don't want to hear. Get back to classic Christian books that built up Christian civilization. Boycott the modern trash that's tearing it down. And thankfully, we can access a lot of these old classics online even. So we've got no excuse not to get it. Home education using Bible-based, Christ-centered, God-honoring textbooks approved by your cats may be the single most strategic, important foundation that can be laid for reclaiming our culture for Christ. Home education is so anti-politically correct. In fact, that could be the one great silver lining to this whole COVID-19 lockdown pandemic hoax, is that many people have been forced to homeschool. And it would be great if a whole lot decided not to send their kids back to the indoctrination gulags afterwards. And so Christian Liberty Books has 6,000 titles. Most of our book sales are home education, over 80% actually. Some of the antidote to psyops, gaslighting, guilt manipulation, Stockholm syndrome, cultural Marxism, indoctrination are examples of excellence that we can learn in Christian history, which is why the Reformation Society started in the first place. 32 chapters on 32 examples of excellence from the 2nd century through to the 20th century in victorious Christians who changed the world. Now these are examples of excellence, and they destroy the narratives, all the politically correct narratives they've been indoctrinating us with. There's nothing like the truth, like the Great Century Reformation, 16 biographies of 16 greatest reformers of the 16th century, or 19 biographies of 19 missionaries of the 19th century, or sketches from South African history, which we also have in Afrikaans. History is a battlefield, and we need to know our history because Marxists are rewriting history, and they're trying to destroy our history. And when they want to make such a big scene about slavery, do you know that only 4.4% of all the slaves that crossed the Atlantic went to North America? 96% of the slaves went to Central and South America. But all the attention is on North America. Why? Because that's where the Protestants are. Let's hit them. Do you know more whites were enslaved from Europe and brought into North Africa, twice as many as all the blacks who ever went to North America as slaves? Vastly more white people were kidnapped by Muslim slave raiders and taken to North Africa than blacks ever crossed the Atlantic to get to North America. Not counting the ones that went to South and Central America. Haiti, Jamaica, Brazil, that's another stat. But there was over 1.1 million European slaves kidnapped from Europe, and they built virtually everything in North Africa. The harbors, the palaces, the forts, the castles. Slavery terrorism, historical roots and contemporary threat also points out that Muslim slavery is not ended. Britain's involvement in the slave trade ended in 1807, 200 years ago. America's involvement ended more than 150 years ago. The Islamic slave trade is still going on in Sudan right now, and Mauritania, and Saudi Arabia, and a whole lot of other places. And we need to get back to the Bible. And the more we study every book of the Bible, the more we realize that most of our churches have drifted so far from the Bible, it's just not even funny. Our Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism Facebook page has got a lot of news that is current but not very popular. And our website, the HMS School of Christian Journalism.org, lots of alternative Christian perspectives on the current revolutionary activity. And MovieGuide.org, Ted Beer's excellent site to evaluate films. It's important to know before you go, to learn to discern, to clean the screen, to boycott the bad, to support the good, the uplifting, and the excellent. Dr. David Noble's Understand Times is the single best textbook to understand the competing worldviews from Marxism, humanism, cosmic humanism, New Age, all the way through to the biblical worldview. And he summarized this in the Battle for Truth book. Answers in Genesis, the Creation Museum, Ark Encounter are vital strategic antidotes to the secular humanism, the evolutionary foundations, the revolutionary revolution facing us today. effective evangelistic tools to seek to win our world to Christ can be found in Living Waters, Way of the Master, Ten Commandments-based evangelistic material, using the law of the Lord, which is perfect to convert the soul. Our Great Commission course is an intensive training program for those who want to make disciples of the nations. And those who can't come to it, at least we've got the audios and a lot of the PowerPoints and videos online as well. And our next one's middle of next year, 2021, to put future faith. Our Biblical Worldview Summit is an intensive training course for those who want to apply the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life. For practical principles for every area of life, you'll find the Ten Commandments, God's perfect law of liberty. And Biblical Principles for Africa, one of our most popular books. We've had to reprint this over and over again, and it's also in French and Afrikaans. This has been our bestseller, amazingly, since it first came out in 2002. You can access a lot of our lectures and presentations of previous Biblical Worldview Summits, Reformation Society lectures, Great Commission courses on our frontlinemissionsa.org website. We've got audio and video galleries. And to counter many of the attacks made on the faith, our Answering Skeptics book, battle-tested, factual, scriptural response to 14 common attacks on the faith. You will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. J.C. Ryle, in the 19th century, Church of England bishop, said, "Never let us be guilty of sacrificing any portion of the truth on the altar of peace. Truth is more important than peace. We are more than conquerors through Christ Jesus who loved us. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from us. Greater is he who is in us than him who is in the world." So we need to stand up, step out, and fight the good fight of faith, which involves smashing cultural Marxism. So, comments, questions, observations?
Yes. I want to ask about Colonel Breitenbach.
Yes.
Has he passed away?
He's in his 80s, but he's quiet these days, but he still makes it to some events. I've seen him just in the last year. Do you know Anthony? I haven't seen him in a while, but I saw he made some appearance at some memorial events last year. He lives in Sedgefield, just past Wilderness, and good man. So he was fighting already in 1956 in the Fleet Air Arm. And then 1961, I think they started our Parabats at Tempe. He was one of the first. And he fought even up in Biafra during the Biafran Civil War on the Biafran side. Took a company of South African Parabats up there. It's still so secret, I don't think it's ever been written about. He was in the last plane out. If you've seen the Dogs of War film, which begins with the Dakota taking off with everything blowing up, although they've got in South America, but in the book it's actually in Nigeria, in Uli. He was the author, Frederick Forsyth, based it on Colonel Breitenbach's experience. Well, then he's Captain Breitenbach. As he was in the last DC-3 taking off from Uli. Uli landing strip was nothing but a strip of the road in the jungle, and everything was just exploding all around as the federal forces came in. He's lived a charmed life. I think he'd been somewhere 56 battles. Most combat decorated man in South African army history, as far as I know. Quite a character. And by the way, when I turned up with him, Brigadier, who's second command of Southwest Territorial Force, he said to me, "We couldn't control Colonel Breitenbach when he was in the SSDF, and just when we think we're free of him, he comes back under frontline fellowship." And because I'd been invited to take the big tea, which is a Friday tea time chaplain service, everyone from General Mayring, OC, down was there, and they all had to be there, everyone in their best, and I was meant to speak then. Doubtless I would have been more polite, but next thing I hand over to Colonel Breitenbach, and I think they're all in a state of shock, because he just let rip. I mean, he knew everyone's sins. I mean, he'd be pointing, and he'd be naming guys, and what they were up to, and conviction. No Dominie would do this, you know. Colonel Breitenbach is just such an evangelist. Outstanding.
He's a strong soldier in the army.
When he got converted, and absolutely staggering. I remember when we went up to the border in 1989 for the outreach. Well, actually, before we got up the border, at the training camp, we held us down Noordhoek, and Colonel Breitenbach, he came and he saw John Michael Tors. Well, you know John Michael Tors. And Colonel said, John Michael, what are you doing here? Have you got religion too? And I, and people were just stunned because John Michael was known as such a pagan before. You know, how did he get converted? And up at the border, people said, but you used to chew the tops of beer bottles and drink out the jagged edge. Chew the glass. I mean, the guy was totally nuts. And he said, yeah, well, that's before I got converted. But he was, John Michael was quite a character anyway. But the colonel and him, they got up to all sorts of nonsense. And so at our GCCs, at our camps, the colonel would be, okay, I'm gonna track you. John Michael, you lead off a team and you do anti-tracking. And, you know, who wants to be tracked by Colonel Breitenbach? He trained them all. And so, I mean, we all got caught, obviously, but I'm sure we learned things. Now, I mean, imagine having great commissioned course where you've got someone like Colonel Breitenbach training you. It's such a privilege. A funny thing is you'd be watching a film with him like Cromwell, and I mean, the funny remarks he'd make with everything. So, you know the Cromwell film, and yeah, he's, when they're starting to make the Kansai Arms Corps, and when they got the training and selection, and he's just putting the whole thing. You could see, in fact, all the good military technology. It's all there in that. But he's projecting this into this film set in English Civil War 400 years ago, and he's a hilarious person. Trevor has got such a sense of humor, and he loves his animals too. He's a major animal rights activist, and that's one of the reasons why he actually resigned or retired from the army, was because he decided to declare war on Chief of Staff Intelligence, because they were using their secrecy to do ivory poaching in Angola and smuggling out ivory. And of course, the colonel was just blood red furious, and so he launched off, and he's glad to see us, also an animal rights activist who was fully into that. And so he got things published. I mean, he wrote the book The Plunderers, he got into Sunday Times, exposed the whole thing. It was a major scandal. And this is the thing, he just didn't fear anyone. It's just completely willing. But you can imagine some of these characters, we get there and you're at big tea where everyone's meant to be respectful, and he's naming, you know, you bloody this and the other, you're involved in the ivory poaching and you're this and the other. I mean, he knew what these guys were up to, and these guys are just sinking through the floorboards. In fact, General Mulder said he travelled with Jan, as he calls the colonel, in Angola in 1975 during the Operation Savannah. And he said they were advancing so far, so fast, they were going into their own artillery barrage. And he's saying, Jan, you've got to stop this. Landrover, we're going to go into our own artillery. They were advancing too fast. And the colonel says, are you afraid to die? He says, yes, I am afraid to die. He said the colonel just didn't care about anything. He's chasing up after him, chasing off the commies while his own artillery is preparing the way, but he's going into the artillery. And they've got the stuff exploding around him. And so General Mulder, who at that stage I think was a commandant, he's saying, I just couldn't. He said he didn't want to go into a war zone with Colonel Breitenbach. He said he takes too many risks. Yeah.
He never listened.
He would have been a field marshal if he, as somebody said, several people said to me, if he just knew when to shut his mouth, he could have been a field marshal. And, but, for example, he is in staff college, which is essential for you to get upper rank. And he says to this one general, who are you to lecture us on war? You've never heard a shot fired in anger. You've never been in field during a battle. I mean, yeah, it might be true, but that's not the way to get promotion. So, you know, he's insulting the generals, that's the thing. I saw that too. I mean, he'd go in there and he'd just insult people. And you could see how it just grated them, because they couldn't control him when he was in the SADF. They couldn't control him when he left either. But people like that, those are, I mean, you need them during war. And he was such a friend of the animals. What he's done to for conservation too is just spectacular. You know, he got a full, while he was in the army, got full training as a nature conservationist so that he could get responsibility for the Caprivi Game Reserve. And he did this because he knew that nonsense was carrying on up there. And some cabinet ministers were coming up there and shooting animals in the game reserve on Osborats up there. And next thing, he got himself the position of being, he's not just running Fort Doppies and Recce Battalion up there, but he was now the nature conservation guy. And next thing, he's starting to arrest people coming in for and deporting cabinet minister coming up there because he's trying to hunt in the game reserve. And the colonel really did, he went out there, he made the stand. It was brilliant.